thankful again to have this opportunity to be with you this evening. Enjoyed the week so much and getting to know everyone here. I feel, as I said at the beginning of this meeting, I feel so much like I'm at home with brethren here. I know that it has to do with the fact that we have the same hope and the same faith, the same love for the truth and for the Lord. And yet there seems to be something special here that draws me to you. Very wonderful, down-to-earth people, and such wonderful family values that I've seen here. The closeness that I see among the brethren here, it means a lot to me, and I appreciate each one of you so much. It's hard to believe that we're already here at Wednesday evening in this gospel meeting. That means we only have two more opportunities after tonight for you to bring your friends and for us to be able to study with other people here in this community and this effort. And before we know it, I'll be going back home, and I know that my heart will be heavy as I leave you, but I will certainly be excited to be able to see my family again, and I appreciate your prayers on their behalf. I appreciate your patience and your interest in spiritual things. I've had the opportunity to be able to preach on some subjects that take quite a bit of time to be able to develop these subjects, and you've been so kind and so complimentary and so patient with the length of these sermons. I appreciate it so very much. I want to ask you this evening, and I'm pretty sure I know the answer to the question, and that is, how many of you like to wait on things? Do you like to have to wait a long time at a restaurant on a table? I don't. I don't like to wait on anything. You know, we don't like to wait for a table, for a phone operator. And don't you just hate it when you're calling to get some customer service and you have to jump through 20 hoops to be able to find out who you need to speak to? And that time that you wait on that person, how frustrating that is. You know, we prefer fast food. We prefer fast internet. And yes, I even go into the express line at the grocery store when I have more than 15 items in my cart, because I don't like to wait behind people. I want it now. I want things to hurry up. You know, it really hit home with me when I realized that I was very impatient in traffic. I don't like to wait at a light. And when the light turns green and the person in front of me seems to sit there and wait for it to change to a different shade of green before they go, I get a little bit antsy, just a little bit frustrated. And I didn't realize how impatient I was until, and you know, children really bring things home to us. My oldest son, he was only about 5 years old at the time, and we were sitting at a light, and it turned green, and the driver in front of me didn't go, and hesitated for a minute, and my five-year-old son said, "Hurry up, you idiot!" And I thought, I think I know where he's heard that kind of language, and it made me realize I need to reform some things and change some things, and I want you to know I have. I don't say things like that anymore at a lot. But the point is that I struggle with this like everyone else does. I don't like to wait. I want things to hurry up. I don't like things to be slow. And this is just something about life, that there are some aspects of life that we've got to learn to be patient with. You know, the old saying goes that good things come to those, the rest of it, who wait. Good things come to those who wait. When we try to rush things, when we want them now, we don't get the good things. And you know, the Lord teaches us that same lesson. And this is the lesson that I want you to consider with me this evening, is the lesson that the Lord teaches us in Isaiah chapter 40 and in verse 31. If you'll notice this particular text with me, he says in Isaiah 40, beginning in verse 28, he says, "Have you not known, have you not heard, the everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, He increases strength. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." I want you to notice the emphasis the Lord places here on patience and the strength and the blessings that will come as we wait on the Lord. This is a lesson that it seems like it takes us getting to a certain age to really appreciate.
It seems like the younger that we are, the more impatient that we are. And I appreciate older Christians, the older that they get, how they're able to be so calm in the midst of chaos, and they're able to be patient and to wait on things. They've learned by reason of use. They've had their senses exercised. And I want mine to be like that. I want to learn these lessons. I want to be better at that. And certainly I have developed and grown in this area. But I want you to realize that in youth is one of the most important areas for us to learn this lesson. That those who wait on the Lord will renew their strength and mount up on wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. He expresses the fact in verse 30 that the youth shall faint and be weary. And I think that he's implying here that many times we see that those who are young and full of vitality and energy, they don't like to wait on anything, and so they rush along, and sometimes as we grow older, it almost feels like we're going to be the ones left behind. Those who have that vitality, that strength, and that energy that don't wait, and they hurry up, if we don't hurry up and try to see something, then we're going to miss out. But God says no. He says, I give strength to the weary. But to those who wait on the Lord, they are the ones that I'll give the strength to. They are the ones that will mount up with wings like eagles. But you have to wait for those things to come. I want you to realize, ladies and gentlemen, that the Bible is telling us that we need to learn to wait for certain things. You know, Israel was such a bad example of this in the wilderness in Exodus chapter 17. And in verse 2, as they murmured against Moses and Aaron when they were out in the wilderness, and they murmured because they had no water, and they complained and said, we should have stayed back in Egypt. We should have just died there as slaves. It would have been better to be where we are now. What was their problem overall, the Israelites? It was that they were not willing to wait on the promised land. They wanted it now. They wanted to take the quick train from Egypt to Canaan. They did not have the patience, the maturity, the spirituality, the trust, the faith to be able to go through that wilderness in order to get there. And remember, they weren't wandering in the wilderness yet. They were going around to hit Mount Sinai, and then they were going to go on. But here they are murmuring against God and against Moses because they didn't like to wait. I don't know if you used to use what we call the old red songbooks here, Sacred Selections. I grew up on that songbook. And there was a song in that book that's not in the books that we use now, the ones that we have at home and the ones that you use here. It was number 339 in the old Sacred Selections. It was called Wait and Murmur Not. Wonderful song. Beautiful song. And it spoke about the fact how the Israelites murmured against God, and how we need to learn when we are waiting, when we're praying for something, when we're not getting it, when we think we ought to get it, that we don't start murmuring. You know, we can see it so clearly in the Israelites. But how is it that we fail to recognize that we can be just like them when we're not getting what we want? When we're praying for something, and then we begin to complain and murmur and speak to other Christians about it, talk to the elders and preacher. Well, I've been praying about this for over a week. I've been praying about this for over a month. And I'm just not, God's not answering my prayer. You know that He does answer prayers. Sometimes His answer is wait. Sometimes His answer is yes. Sometimes His answer is no. And sometimes His answer is wait. And Isaiah is telling us that there are some things that we need to learn to wait on. You know, in 2 Peter chapter 3 and in verse 9, the Bible tells us that God is not slack concerning His promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us. Now notice what he's saying there. I know he's talking about judgment here, but he's telling us something about the nature, about the character of God. God is not slack concerning His promise. When God makes a promise, when He says He'll do something, He's going to do it. But at that same time, He is long-suffering. God can wait a long time. That's why He goes on in the very text and says that 1,000 years is as a day to the Lord, and a day as 1,000 years. Time is not a barrier to God. He can wait forever. And God wants us to learn that we have to be able to wait as well for certain things.
God is long-suffering, and He wants us to be long-suffering. He wants us to be patient.
Think about the example of Nebuchadnezzar. In the book of Daniel, in chapter 4, God warned Nebuchadnezzar that because of his pride, God was going to humble him. He was going to lower him. And then it didn't happen. And then it didn't happen. And then it didn't happen. And it went on for over a year. But then one day, in Daniel chapter 5, and verses 20 through 21, Nebuchadnezzar, he was walking through his kingdom, and he observed and spoke about all of the great things that his hands had provided. And at that moment, God did what he said. Nebuchadnezzar was driven out of the city and made to live in the fields as a wild beast until he was humbled. Until he was humbled and he recognized his need for God. But my point is that God told him it would happen. And you know, it was very easy for Nebuchadnezzar to say to himself,
well, you know, I know God said that, but he hasn't done it yet. It hasn't happened yet. Maybe it's not going to happen. You know, that's kind of like in Galatians chapter 6, when he tells us in verses 7 and verse 8,
he tells us, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. See, there are a lot of people that think that God is not going to do, that people can get by with murder, you know, that they can get off scot-free. He says, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. Sometimes
the difficulty in that lesson is that you always reap later than you sow. You put a seed in the ground. You don't go out the next day and say, where are my green beans? You put that seed in the ground and you know it's going to be a while. You always reap later than you sow. And there is a deception to that, because sometimes we sow these wild oats. We live this life that is in rebellion to God, and we don't see a crop and we think, oh boy, I did it. I got by with it. There's not going to be any consequence. And so then we're tempted to just keep on going down that road. And then all of a sudden, that crop starts coming after us like an avalanche. No, my friends, God is patient. He waits. Do not be deceived. And so we've got to learn to wait on the Lord and to understand His long-suffering and to be willing to wait for those things that need to be waited for. This evening, I want you to consider with me just one thing. Believe it or not, that's right, we're just going to look at one thing tonight. There are so many different areas that we could go with this lesson. So many different things that we need to learn to wait on in waiting for the Lord. We need to wait for the right kind of growth in the church. We don't need to try to push it, as we talked about on Monday night, try to come up with the schemes of men to try to grow the church in our own way. We need to wait on the Lord in that regard. We need to wait on the Lord for our home, for our eternal home. You know, there are a lot of young people today that I have observed, I was mentioning this to someone the other day, even in my generation, but especially even after my generation, there's so many young people that they leave their parents' home and they want what their parents have right now.
Amen.
I want to tell you, that's just not the way that it works. My parents lived in an old garage apartment and got by with one car, got by without a car for a long time, used public transportation to get to work. And yes, they have worked hard, they have saved, they've been frugal, they've been wise, they've done without things, and they have some things now. And isn't it prideful? Wouldn't it be prideful for me to come along and to grow up and to leave the house and say, I think I ought to have everything that mom and dad have right now? Well, I'm telling you, we're living in a culture and a generation like that. And as Christians, we need to see beyond that. We need to realize there are some things that need to be waited for. And above all things, we need to wait for our home in heaven. Instead of giving our lives to these temporal things, as we talked about on Sunday, we need to wait for our home in heaven. We need to learn to wait for vindication. You know, it is such a temptation when someone hurts us or is mean to us that we want to lash out, especially when we know that we can be cutting with our words. Maybe we're very witty or maybe we just have a gift of sarcasm and that we can come right back at them. It's very difficult to bite your tongue, isn't it? It's hard to wait. But we've got to wait for the Lord's vindication. David is an example of that. When Nabal showed cruelty to David when David had protected his men. And David was going to kill him, but Nabal's wife, Abigail, said, "No, don't do that. Don't put blood on your hands. Let God take care of it." And wasn't it amazing how God avenged David in that regard? God can always avenge us much better than we can avenge ourselves. Wait for vindication. Let God take care of it. Commit that to Him. There's so many different areas where we need to wait on the Lord. But tonight
I want to speak especially to the young people, and I want you to think about this one area with me. And that is that those who wait on the Lord wait until marriage.
Those who wait on the Lord learn to wait until marriage. What do I mean by that? Well, for one thing, we've got to learn to wait for that intimate relationship that belongs in marriage.
In Hebrews chapter 13, turn to that passage with me if you will. The Hebrew writer says there in chapter 13 and in verse 4, "Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers, God will judge." There is a contrast that is given in this passage. And that contrast is between the one who waits for that sexual relationship until there is a marriage, a lifelong marriage bond, and the other person who does not wait on that relationship and seeks to have that kind of gratification outside of a lifelong covenant between two people and God. This
can very easily set the course for the rest of your life, young people. That is waiting until the proper time for this blessing. And I want you to know this is a blessing of God. It is a wonderful blessing that God gives us to be able to have an intimate relationship with another person. But God has confined that to a place where we can only enjoy that relationship when we have committed ourselves for the rest of our life to that person. And I want to tell you there's a reason for that. That intimate, that sexual relationship will be completely different, so much better that it cannot even be described, if it is enjoyed with the person that you have committed to love and to care for and to be with and to be there for the rest of your life. It is more of an emotional bond and an attachment instead of just a physical event. And God knew that. He made us. He created us. And He knows what will bless our lives. He knows what will really fully and truly gratify us in life. And He knows that this sexual, this intimate relationship is a wonderful thing if and only if it is between two people who've made a covenant to love and to care for one another for the rest of their life. Ladies and gentlemen, I cannot emphasize the importance of this. And you know, we see this. We see its importance in the Song of Solomon. The Song of Solomon is such a wonderful book, and parents, we need to be reading this to our kids. You know, so many times parents will read every book in the Bible to their kids, and they'll skip over the Song of Solomon because there are some parts of it that we might be uncomfortable with that talk about the sexual relationship. Parents, listen. Let us never forget Hebrews 13:4, that marriage is honorable. And that the bed, that is the sexual relationship in marriage, is undefiled. There is nothing that's dirty about it. There is nothing that is wrong about it. It is a beautiful thing, and that needs to be represented to our children so that they don't carry that kind of Victorian baggage into their marriage and then try to hide things from their kids. We need to speak about what God speaks about physical attraction, about having these feelings, and it's normal, and it's natural, and it's beautiful. But it has to be disciplined like every other desire has to be disciplined. And it has to be focused. It has to follow the right avenue, and it has to find the right fulfillment and gratification, and that's in marriage. But we've got to talk to our kids about that and teach them that this is a wonderful thing. And we've got to start when they're young enough that they don't get weirded out by it. You know, we wait until they're going to college to talk to them. It's not going to work. Someone said, if you haven't talked to your kids before they're 6, don't try to talk to them when they're 16.
And I'm not saying that we tell them everything when they're six, but we're giving them the information and certain aspects of marriage so that they can understand what is natural and what is beautiful and what is good. They need to learn it from us and not their friends at school. And there are too many young Christians that are learning these things at school instead of from the Bible. Song of Solomon in chapter 2. What a beautiful love story. Beautiful love story between the Shulamite and her love. She's in love with this young man. And in chapter 2, I want you to read with me now, in beginning in verse 4.
She says, "He brought me to the banqueting house." So they're going out on a date, as we would say in our culture. "He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am love sick." Now stop right there. This is a young girl that is swept off of her feet. Now, you know, I'll admit, she's a little dramatic, I think. You know? But I mean, this is a girl. She's excited. She says, "Sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I'm lovesick." It's really fun to read. It's exciting to read about a young girl that is in love like this, and the young man that she's in love with, he's just making her heart go pitter-patter. And did you notice she said, "His banner over me is love"? What does that mean? Young men, if you don't know what that means, you need to know. What she's saying is that this young man that she's in love with, he is expressing to everyone around them that she is the young lady that he loves. In other words, he's manifesting it by what he does. Young men, when you open the door for a young woman, you're putting a banner over her of love. Everyone sees that she's exclusive, that she's special, that she comes first, that you respect her, that you value her. When you walk beside her, I've seen young couples there in Lubbock. It's so funny to see these couples as they first begin dating and the awkwardness and everything that happens. And I'll never forget, just a few months ago, a young couple, they just started dating, and Jennifer and I pull up in the parking lot. This is the first Wednesday night that this couple rode to church together, you know. And of course, my wife, being the matchmaker, she's just wringing her hands, you know. And we get out of the car, and we notice he gets out, she gets out, and he just takes off. And I'll bet he was 10 paces ahead of her. And we just hung our heads. Jennifer said, "Fred, talk to him. His banner over her was not love." And as guys, we don't fully appreciate that. We don't get how important that is to our girlfriends and to our wives. It doesn't end when we quit dating and when we get married. Women appreciate that. You want to just sweep your wife off of her feet. Your banner over her needs to be love. And sometimes that means that when you're having company over, don't just sit in the living room like a big rock. Go in there in the kitchen and help her. Show that you care for her. I know that she has this domestic responsibility and that you're out there making the living. That doesn't mean you can't help her. Open a door or open a jar of pickles or wash a dish off. Show people how much you love your wife. It means everything to them for others to see how important they are to you. And that's a part of what made her lovesick. This young man's banner over her was love. But notice then, here she is, swept away in this romantic feeling. And then in verse 6 she says, "His left hand is under my head. His right hand embraces me." Stop right there. It's almost as if she came to her senses. Boom. In verse 7, she says, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the goats of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases." Here is a typical situation. Many of us have been there. She is not married to this young man yet. They're on a date. He's doing everything right. He's a handsome young man. His banner over her is love. She's swept away, and now he begins to touch her. His left hand is under her head. His right arm embraces her. And now something totally different is being felt. Something totally different. They're opening a different door. They're going down a different path. And that's when she says, stop. Do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. I cannot tell you, young people who are not yet married, how important it is to take this divine, inspired advice. Do not stir up and awaken those feelings until it's time. And it's not time until you're married. I know that that sounds crazy. I know that it's going to make you an oddity. That people of the world, they think that that's just crazy. That when they date, they're going to be intimate with one another. And that they think that that's just a part of the game. That's just a part of what you do when you date. But God says it's not. God says don't even stir those feelings up. Feelings of friendship, feelings of romance, feelings of elation because this young man loves you. That's all great. That needs to be there. But the feelings that are stirred up by the touch, those are the things that do not need to be stirred up. You're messing with dynamite. There is no stronger power, no stronger desire that you can mess with than this desire and this power right here. And that's why she says, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Look with me at what the wise man says in the book of Proverbs. In Proverbs chapter 7. Back up to Proverbs in chapter 7. And notice the wise man says in verse 6, At the window of my house I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner.
And he took the path to her house in the twilight, the evening, in the black and the dark of night. When's all this happening? Young people, you know how your parents tell you nothing good happens after midnight? The Bible reveals to us that there are certain things that find freedom in the cover of darkness. And there's a lot of wisdom in the fact that that is not a good time for us to be out, to be unchaperoned, to be in a place like this young man was. In verse 10, there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot. She's dressed immodestly. That says something, young men, about the young women that you date. You do not need to date a young woman that does not dress in a modest way. You say, well, I'm going to teach her. Well, then teach her before you date her. Okay? You do not need that temptation before you. He says then, she was loud and rebellious. Verse 12, she was lurking at every corner. Verse 13, she caught him and kissed him. Notice the immediate physical connection that was there. And then she begins to charm him. Verse 14, I've made peace offerings. Verse 15, I came out to meet you. You know what she's saying? I've been watching you. You're so handsome. I've been looking for you. You're exactly the young man I was looking for. That's a lie. This immoral woman, she wasn't looking for any one person at all. But she's charming this young man. She says in verse 18, come, let us take our fill of love until morning. See how she's misusing that word? In verse 21, with her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver. As a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. There are lifelong consequences to this. They never go away. Then in verse 24, he says, listen to me. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths. Listen now, verse 26 and 27. For she has cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were weak. Is that what it says? No. All who were slain by her were strong men. Do not be deceived, young men, young ladies, to think that you can go into this realm of intimacy and that you can only go so far and you're going to stop it there because you're strong, you're a Christian, you know what's right, you know what's wrong. You would never go there. All who were slain by her were strong men. You don't even open that door. Do not stir up or awaken those feelings until you are married. He goes on in the Proverbs and tells us, if you'll back up here to chapter 6,
He says in verse 23, in Proverbs chapter 6, in verse 23, he says, "The commandment is a lamp, and the law is a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep you from the immoral woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids." Listen to verse 27. "Can a man take fire to his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared?" Young people, he's asking a rhetorical question, and the answer is no. You cannot commit this sin and it not have lasting consequences. And notice the figure that he uses, walking on hot coals, taking fire to your bosom. He's talking about the burn, the scar. Scars from burns don't go away. And consequences from this sin, they don't go away. I'm not saying you can't be forgiven, but you will live with the scars. And it's not something that you want in your life. Back in chapter 5, he says in verses 1 through 6, "My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Lend your ear to my understanding, that you may preserve discretion, that, and your lips may keep knowledge, for the lips of an immoral woman drip honey." Yes, it looks attractive, he says, "and her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of hell. Lest you ponder her path of life. Her ways are unstable. You do not know them." You may think that this is just a part of youth, but it will live with you until you die. You cannot walk on hot coals and your feet not be burned. In chapter 9, he says in verses 17 through 18, "Stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant, but he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of hell." It's going to seem exciting. That date, you find yourself alone, no one knows you're there. You begin to find those feelings stirred up. And yes, that stolen water is sweet and that bread eaten in secret is pleasant, but that's where the dead are. And it is going to have a lasting consequence in your life.
How do you avoid it? I mean, it is a natural thing that you're going to want to get to know someone, whether or not they're going to be someone that you're interested in marrying. How are you going to get to know them? How are you going to date them? How are you going to be able to be with them and it not become intimate and not stir up those feelings and those emotions? Let me give you some advice. And I know that this is going to sound very simple. It's going to sound probably crazy to you in our culture today. But if you really want to go to heaven more than anything else, and you want to find a mate and have a relationship with them that is sweet and pure and beautiful, and you don't want to have regrets after you're married, take this advice. Number one, first of all, as I said, when you're dating, you make sure that you dress absolutely modest without any compromise. I don't care what the style of the day is. You make sure that what you're wearing does not uncover any part of the body that God does not allow uncovered, that the thigh is not uncovered, that we're not uncovering the top of the body that's going to lend to lust or temptation. And I'm talking about both men and women. Make sure that if you wear shorts that they are long enough that they're not uncovering any part of your body that's going to stir up or awaken those feelings. And you make sure that you don't date someone that dresses in that way. Don't go to a movie where you're going to see those types of images that's going to stir up those kinds of feelings. Don't rent those kinds of movies. Stay away from that environment. Do not listen to the popular hip-hop music that is almost totally and completely sexual. I know it's got a good beat. I know it's got a good rhythm. I know there are a lot of songs out there that are fun to listen to. But I want to tell you, there are very few of those songs that you can listen to and it not influence you. If you think that music doesn't influence us, why, oh why, does God tell us of the importance of singing in our worship to Him? Music influences and affects the emotions. And that's the very thing that we've got to try to control. Watch how you dress. Don't date someone who dresses immodest. Be careful about the music, the movies, the TV shows, any of the entertainment that you're involved in. And then, don't ever let yourself be alone with your date out of the public eye. You know why I say that? And I'm not saying that you can't go and sit at a private table over here in a restaurant, certainly. Or that you can't ride in a car by yourselves, going down the freeway to go shopping or something like that. I'm not talking about that. What I'm talking about is to go parking, as we used to say in my generation. That means going off somewhere where no one sees you, no one is around. That means not being alone at your parents' house together, or back in your bedroom with the door shut together, or being at her apartment or being at his apartment. Do not be alone out of the public eye. And here's the reason why. I don't believe that there is a young person here that will do anything inappropriate as far as this goes, as long as there are other people around to see. That is one of the best safeguards that you can have. It's an accountability. If you make sure that you're always in the public eye, whether it's in a restaurant or a movie theater or a shopping mall or with your parents there in the same room or friends in the same room, someone's always around you, you're not going to slip off into this hole. You're going to always guard those feelings. Just make that commitment. And you make sure that before you ever start dating someone, that you sit down and you explain the ground rules. You're not going back to their apartment with them unless someone else is there. They're not coming to your apartment unless someone else is there. You're not going to go to their parents' house if their parents are not there and in some place where they can see you. And parents, we need to wake up and smell the coffee. Sometimes, you know, our kids think that we don't know what it was like being a kid. And sometimes I wonder if parents have lost some portion of their brain. When they have grown up and dated and they know the challenges and they know the temptations are there and they let their kids be at their house alone together, or they let them go upstairs or into a bedroom and close the door. Have we gone brain dead after we turn 40? What is it? It is our job to help our kids stay safe. And that's one of the most important things we can do, is to make sure that there is constant accountability there to protect them from the horrific consequences of that moment's mistake. And I'm talking about a moment. People my age will remember when Magic Johnson had been diagnosed with the HIV virus. And it shocked us. I mean, how could he get that? I don't know, but I can tell you, I bet it happened like that. One short, quick mistake that seemed innocent, seemed simple, lived with him all his life. And he is certainly an exception to the rule, because most people that would contract that would not have the same outcome that he had. But it can change so quickly. Let me tell you something else. And since I'm just going to progress here, let me make another suggestion. Let me make another plea to you. Turn over to Romans chapter 13 and in verse 14. This is a principle, young people, that you need to have indelibly printed in your mind as frontlets before your eyes, written on your doorpost. It needs to be there. This verse needs to be memorized. It needs to be with you wherever you go, at any moment, at any time of any day. In Romans 13, he says in verse 13, or let's begin back here in verse 12, "The night is far spent, the day is at hand, therefore let us cast off the works of darkness, let us put on the armor of light, let us walk properly, as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy." He says we need to walk as in the day. See, he's talking about when people can see. Walk as if we are being watched. Then verse 14, this is what I want you to memorize. "But put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts." Make no provision. That's what he said. Make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. What kind of things can you do that makes a provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts in regards to intimacy outside of marriage? Well, dressing immodest is certainly a way that you make a provision for the flesh It stirs up the lust of the desire of the flesh. Being alone together, where no one else is around, is a way that you make a provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. Let me suggest something else to you that I don't believe that young Christians should even consider in dating, and yet it is as common as it can be. And that is the passionate kiss in dating. That's right. I'm serious. You know, when I was growing up, that was almost a rite of passage that, you know, when you kiss the first girl, you know. And if you had to kiss the girl, then there was something wrong with you, had cooties or something. You know, we need to dispel that theory. We need to be talking to our kids about this. And furthermore, it was, I mean, in middle school, in junior high, kids were making out, and kissing was just something that was common among young couples, even in middle school and junior high. And people were talking about it in grade school, and who knows how soon they're starting now. I want to ask you something. What place does a passionate kiss have in a dating relationship? What does it do? What does it accomplish? You know, when you're dating someone, you're trying to get to know them. You're trying to find out if they're the kind of person you want to marry. You're trying to find out something about their character, about their parents, about their family life, about what kind of friend they can be with you. I want to know, how does a passionate kiss help you in that regard? And I'm not talking about a peck on the cheek. You know, 1 Timothy chapter 5 tells young men who are Christians to entreat an older man as a father, and older women as mothers, and the younger women as sisters with all purity. Do you know that includes the young woman that you date, young men? You know that if you would treat her like your sister, that you wouldn't have anything to worry about? You say, I never go out with my sister. Well, you know, I mean, when I see my sister, I love her so much. Every time we see each other, we give each other a big hug, and we give each other a kiss on the cheek. Nothing inappropriate about that at all. And there's nothing inappropriate about that if you're dating someone. And treat them as a sister with all purity. That's the first part of 1 Timothy chapter 5. I'm not talking about that kind of kiss. I'm talking about the passionate kiss. And you know what I mean. You know what I'm talking about. I want to ask you, what place does that have between two people that are not married? I'll tell you what it does. It makes a provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. All that does is stir up and awaken those feelings. That's all it does. It's not a greeting. You know it's not. You say, well, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think it's completely pure. Well, how about some other man kiss your wife that way? Huh? If it's absolutely pure, why not? Huh? You know why not. Because you know what it does. And that has no place whatsoever in a relationship before marriage. It stirs up and it awakens those feelings where they have no place, and it makes a provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. Young people, what this amounts to, what this really boils down to is, how bad do you want to go to heaven, keep your life pure, and have a marriage that's built on purity? How important is that to you? How valuable is it to you? And if it is as valuable as it ought to be, as the Bible says that it ought to be, you will pull out every stop. You'll do whatever it takes to keep yourself pure. And I'm telling you, what I've suggested here, the way you dress, the entertainment, never be alone out of the public eye, and absolutely never involve yourself or engage in a passionate kiss with someone that you're not married to. And I'll tell you, you're going to go a long ways in accomplishing that goal. Wait until marriage for that intimate relationship. And let me make one more point. I told you we just had this one point, but it's a long one, isn't it? One more point. I'm taking the time on it because I did not have anyone that I can remember talk straight to me about this when I was dating. I heard preachers preach about fornication being a sin. I heard people talk about how it's sinful to go all the way, and they would talk about it in vague generalities. You can't do that today. You shouldn't have been doing it back then. I needed someone to talk straight to me about these issues and to tell me these dangers. the end. It's certainly my fault for any mistakes that I made. But we have got to inform young people, brethren. We've got to preach on these things and we've got to talk straight about them. And they need to understand what they're facing. In this same point, waiting until marriage, we need to learn to wait for the right helpmeet. I see young people so many times trying to rush things. They're trying to find someone. They feel like they're getting too old. They're never going to find anyone. All of their friends around them are getting married. And so they get in a hurry and they go out here and they start dating someone that they have no business being involved with. Someone who's not interested in spiritual things or someone who is not showing the right character traits. We need to try to find someone who's going to help us go to heaven. I was telling Dan and Shirley that is something that I appreciated and that really it sealed the deal for me. As I saw my wife Jennifer make decisions in her youth that were courageous decisions of faith, and I said to myself, that's who I want to marry. I want a young woman who is going to stand on her own faith, her own conviction. She'll not be a rubber stamp to me. She'll not be a yes woman. She'll not be a carbon copy. She's going to determine the truth and take a stand. I need a wife like that. And young men, you do too. Young women, you need a man that's going to provide for you and have conviction and love the Lord and lead His family in spiritual ways. Look with me in Proverbs chapter 31 and listen to what the wise man here says about this godly woman. In Proverbs chapter 31 and in verse 10, he says, "Who can find a virtuous wife? Her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life." Think about that. Young men, are you really considering the girl that you're dating and how well she fits that? Can your heart safely trust in her? Do you have to worry about her flirting with other guys when you're not around? How about the way that she dresses? Are you going to be able to safely trust in her? What about the way that she spends money? This says that she does him good, no evil, all the days of his life. He will have no lack of gain. You know, there are a lot of girls out there that spend money like there's no tomorrow. You can't make enough money to keep them happy. How about this girl that you're dating? How about this girl that you're interested in? I want to tell you, there are very few miseries that are as miserable as being married to a young woman that you can't trust. Either as far as marital fidelity or as far as money goes. And I want to tell you, there's just as much of a problem in one area as there is in the other. I see so many marriages where men have no idea how much money their wife's spending. She's hiding clothes. She's hiding things. And I'll tell you, there are a lot of husbands that do the same thing. I'm not saying that it's limited to one gender. But I want to tell you, it's a sin either way. It's wrong. And it is a cancer to a marriage. You've got to make sure that you can trust the young woman that you're considering marrying. Look with me in Proverbs chapter 11. In Proverbs chapter 11 and in verse 22, the wise man speaks about marriage in regards to a wife. And he says, "As a ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a lovely woman who lacks discretion." Isn't that a vivid picture that God paints for us? Young men, you're thinking, oh, she's the cutest girl. She's the best looking thing. All the guys want to date her. And you're in high school and you're going to be the most popular guy. You can go out with her and all the other guys want to date her. And she's the prettiest girl. And so you do whatever you've got to do to get to go out with her. Before you know it, you're both falling in love with one another. Why? What is it about her that drew you to this young lady? Because she's cute. What about her character? If she lacks discretion, God says that she's going to be about as pretty as a ring of gold in a swine's snout. Now, how pretty is that? You say, oh, a ring of gold is pretty. Put it in a pig's snout and see how good it looks. And that's how cute this girl will be when you're married to her and she has no discretion when it comes to spiritual things, when it comes to your children, when it comes to morality, when it comes to money, when it comes to the domestic affairs of the home. All of a sudden, that beauty will fade. You need to think about who you're marrying and not get in a hurry, not rush it,
God said in Genesis 2 and verse 18 that our marriage is to be one where we are helpers of one another. He made the woman to be a helpmeet to her husband. In Proverbs 12 and in verse 4, He said, an excellent wife is the crown of her husband. Amen. But she who causes shame is like rottenness in his bones. You know, I can't think of very many descriptions that sound any worse than that. And I want to tell you, there are not many things in life that are worse, husbands, than a wife who causes shame. I know that can be attested to. It is a misery. And not just to pick on the women, but in Proverbs chapter 22 and in verse 24, young ladies, God says, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go. Listen to me. You think that young man is cute and he's so strong, and anytime someone looks at you, he beats them up, and you think that's so cool, and he's just so neat. He's got a hot temper. He's a furious man. He'll get to fight at the drop of a hat. You think that it's neat to have your boyfriend be the toughest boy around. Wait until that temper is turned on you. Or God forbid, and worse yet, wait until it's turned on your children. And all of a sudden that cute boy that we get to fight over you is now taking that temper out on you and your children. Now it's not cute anymore. Now it is as ugly as it can get. Think about the young man that you're marrying. Notice also in Proverbs chapter 24. In Proverbs 24 and in verse 30, he says, I went by the field of the lazy man, and by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding, and there it was, all overgrown with thorns. Its surface was covered with nettles. Its stone wall was broken down. When I saw it, I considered it well. I looked on it and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. So shall your poverty come like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. Young women, as a homemaker, there are very few things more frightening than a husband that will not make a living for you. You know you have a responsibility to care for and those children, and yet your husband cannot keep a job. He always has a reason why he's got to quit this job, why they did him wrong, and why he's looking for another job, and those stints between jobs are so long, and that unemployment just doesn't buy the groceries. And you're ashamed, you're embarrassed, you're afraid. He was so cute though. He was so much fun. And he was so good at football or baseball or whatever it was. You know, all that stuff's fine. But you had better notice what kind of work ethic this young man has.
No! No!
You better notice how he helps his dad around the house.
No!
How does he handle his chores? What is his attitude about work? You know, you find a young man and all he likes to do is play video games, a big red flag better go up in your mind. I don't think it's a sin to play video games, but I want to tell you, they are a cancer that's infecting our young people. We've got young kids that can't hardly go outside and turn a tap because they can't get off the video game. And I know, okay, maybe they're going to be a good pilot someday. How many of them are going to be pilots? That is not what they need to learn. They're getting caught up and consumed in this stuff. And I remember video games. Yeah, they were a big console when I was a kid, you know. But I want to tell you, girls, you need to find a young man that has a respect and an appreciation for working and working hard and being proud of working hard and feeling good about himself for working hard. A young man who does not have the mentality that whatever he can get by with, he'll get by with. Whatever he can mooch, he'll mooch. And whatever he can get his parents to pay for, he can get his parents to pay for. You want to find a young man that has the independence that says, I don't want mom and dad to pay for my meal. I'll pay for it. I'll buy my own gas. Now that's a young man that's going to take care of you. He's going to work, he's going to do what it takes, he's going to find a way, and he's going to provide for his family. And you will not go through the horrors and the fears of poverty because of a lazy husband. In chapter 26 and verse 13, the lazy man says, there's a lion in the road, a fierce lion is in the streets. See, he's always got an excuse to not do what needs to be done. There are chores that are piled up around the house, things that need to be fixed, and you can't get your husband to do it. He won't go to work. He calls in sick every chance he gets. There's always a reason. He's always got a reason. As a door turns on its hinges, so does a lazy man on his bed. The lazy man buries his hand in the bowl and it wearies him to bring it back to his mouth. The lazy man, listen to this, verse 16, he is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. You can go to the elders,
the preacher, older members at church, ask them to talk to your husband. And as wise as they are, they can sit down and explain to him the importance of a job and of providing for his family. And he is going to have a reason why he can't. And his reason and his reasoning and the way that he's figured it all out, he's wiser than them all. They don't understand like he understands. And you'll hang your head in your hands and wonder how you married such a fool. You better think about his work ethic. And that's something that you need to look for today.
Young women, look at how this young man treats his parents. What kind of respect does he have? Young men, look at how your young lady that you're interested in, what is her attitude toward her dad? Does she have respect for him? Or does she talk down to him? Does her mother cut the father with her words? And does the daughter show disrespect for her dad? What's she like around little kids? Do they get on her nerves, or does she love children?
It's going to tell you something about what kind of mother she's going to be. There are a lot of things you need to think about besides what they're good at in school and what they look like. Find someone that is going to help you get to heaven.
You know, I understand how difficult it is to wait for that right person. I understand what it's like to feel like, to think that you're never going to find that person.
I was 31 before I got married. And I reached a point in my life where I really thought that it was the Lord's will for me, that maybe just like as David could not build the temple, Solomon had to build it. I thought maybe because of my past, because of my sins, that God was not going to let me find that person. I was going to have to live the rest of my life single. And I certainly deserved it. And I was ready to live that life. But I remember the sadness and the frustration and thinking, that person's never going to come along. I'm never going to find it. And I see so many times young people back in Lubbock. We have so many college students there. And so many times I will see those who are getting up into their later 20s and they're still so young, but they feel like they're not. And it's because everyone around them seems to be finding someone. They're getting engaged and they're getting married, and here's this girl or here's this young man, and they're just not finding the right person. And they'll come into my office and they'll sit down just so dejected. And sometimes they'll sit there and they'll cry. And my heart breaks because I know they're lonely. I know that they've gone through those years of friendship and of buddies and of friends, and now they're at a point in their life where there's a void that's there and their friends just aren't filling it. And many of their friends are getting married. And I know they're going through that. And they just want to find that person. And I wish so much that I could just pull out a magic wand and find that person for them. I pray for them. I pray about it. But you know what I tell these young people is that my confidence in God and what I trust in is that there is someone that He is preparing and they're almost ready. They may be around the corner. It may be tomorrow. It may be next month. It may be next year. I don't know. I don't know how much work He has to do on this person. But if they will just wait on the Lord. And I can't tell you how many times that when I found a young person that finally resigns himself to wait on the Lord and accept that God is having to prepare someone for them, that it seems like it's almost the next day and they meet that person. We just have to wait. Don't rush it. Don't push it. Don't try to get into a relationship before marriage that where things don't belong. Don't try to just force it and find somebody just for the sake of finding someone. Wait for that right person and wait for the Lord. You know, sometimes it's not that other person that the Lord needs to prepare. Sometimes it's you. So many times young Christians think, well, you know, I know I'm weak spiritually and everything. I just need to find a good Christian to help me. No. You need to get your act straight. You need to get your relationship right with God. Why would God give you to some good Christian? You know? Think about it. You need to get your relationship right with God, and you need to have that relationship to where your relationship is solid and sound with the Lord. That way the Lord comes first, even when you fall in love, because you had a relationship with the Lord first. You get that right. Let the Lord prepare and mold and prepare you. Maybe there's someone He's already prepared, and they're waiting on the Lord for you to hurry up and get your life straight. And there they be. Either way, we need to learn to wait for that right person.
You know, I think about this so many times. It is hard to wait. But the Bible tells us in Genesis 29 and verse 20 that Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Wait on the Lord. It'll be worth your time, and it'll seem as only a few days when that right person comes and you begin your wonderful life together. Waiting on the Lord is difficult. And I know it's hard. I know it's hard when you're young. It's hard when you're older. But you know, as I look back on my life and I think about the times when I had to wait on the Lord, and I think about times even yet when the Lord wants me to wait on Him, you know what I have to remember?
The Lord waited on me some 7 to 10 years when I was out of duty and unfaithful. When I was living my life for myself without regard to Him, and He waited for me. And He waited patiently. And He suffered. He was hurt. He was pained. But He kept waiting on me. My friend, if the Lord could wait on me, I certainly can wait on Him. Because it was my soul that was involved. You can wait on the Lord too. But if you're here this evening and you've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, you need to come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. You need to confess your faith before this audience here tonight. Your faith in Jesus as your Savior. You need to repent of your sins, and you need to be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins. You need to do that before it's too late. And we're extending that invitation to you tonight. The lesson has not been intended to teach a person what to do to be saved, but we're not leaving without extending this invitation to you. And let me say that while we all need to learn to wait on the Lord, you do not need to wait to be baptized. You need to arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord right now. Won't you please come while we stand and sing the invitation song?
Hear the soul.